dude's razors, beneath the toilet tank lid, in the back of the medicine cabinet, even under the drawers in the cupboard, taking each out and examining them from all angles, but couldn't find them. But Andy was right. It was his responsibility. He should have done a better job. And he hadn't. So really, he had failed. "No," said Andy. "I'm really sorry, Willem. It's totally inexcusable. And you're right. I don't know what to do." He sounded tired. "It's just that he's had such a shitty life, Willem. And he trusts you." "I know," he mumbled. "I know he does." So they'd worked out a plan, and when he got back home, he'd monitored Jude more closely than he had before, a process that had proved singularly unrevealing. Indeed, in the month or so after the adoption, Jude was different than he'd seen him before. He couldn't exactly define how. Except on rare occasions, he wasn't ever able to determine the days Jude was unhappy and the days he wasn't. It wasn't as if he normally moped around and was unemotive and then suddenly wasn't. His fundamental behavior and rhythms and gestures were the same as before. But something had changed, and for a brief period, he had the strange sensation that the Jude he knew had been replaced by another Jude, and that this other Jude, this changeling, was someone of whom he could ask anything, who might have funny stories about pets and friends and scrapes from childhood, who wore long sleeves only because he was cold and not because he was trying to hide something. He was determined to take Jude at his word as often and as much as he could. After all, he wasn't his doctor. He was his friend. His job was to treat him as he wanted to be treated, not as a subject to be spied on. And so, after a certain point, his vigilance diminished, and eventually that other Jude departed, back to the land of fairies and enchantments, and the Jude he knew reclaimed his space. But then, every once in a while, there would be troubling reminders that what he knew of Jude was only what Jude allowed him to know. He called Jude daily when he was away shooting, usually at a prearranged time, and one day last year he had called and they'd had a normal conversation, Jude sounding no different than he always did, and the two of them laughing at one of Willem's stories, when he'd heard in the background the clear and unmistakable intercom announcement of the sort one only hears at hospitals. "Paging Dr. Nassarian. Dr. Nassarian to OR3. "Jude?" he'd asked. "Don't worry, Willem," he'd said. "I'm fine. I just have a slight infection. I think Andy's gone a little crazy." "What kind of infection? Jesus, Jude!" "A blood infection. But it's nothing. Honestly, Willem, if it was serious, I would have told you." "No, you fucking wouldn't have, Jude. A blood infection is serious." He was silent. "I would have, Willem." "Does Harold know?" "No," he said sharply. "And you're not to tell him." Exchanges like this left him stunned and bothered, and he spent the rest of the evening trying to remember the previous week's conversations, picking through them for clues that something might have been amiss, and he might have simply, stupidly overlooked it. In more generous, wondering moments, he imagined Jude as a magician, whose sole trick was concealment. But every year, he got better and better at it, so that now he had only to bring one wing of the silken cape he wore before his eyes, and he would become instantly invisible, even to those who knew him best. But at other times, he bitterly resented this trick, the year-after-year exhaustion of keeping Jude's secrets, and yet never being given anything in return but the meanest smidges of information, of not being allowed the opportunity to even try to help him, to publicly worry about him. "This isn't fair," he would think in those moments. "This isn't friendship. It's something, but it's not friendship." He felt he had been hustled into a game of complicity, one he never intended to play. Everything Jude communicated to them indicated that he didn't want to be helped, and yet he couldn't accept that. The question was how you ignored someone's request to be left alone, even if it meant jeopardizing the friendship. It was a wretched little koan. How can you help someone who won't be helped while realizing that if you don't try to help, then you're not being a friend at all? Talk to me, he sometimes wanted to shout at Jude. Tell me things. Tell me what I need to do to make you talk to me. Once, at a party, he had overheard Jude tell someone that he told him, Willem, everything, and he had been both flattered and perplexed because, really, he knew nothing. It was sometimes incredible to him how much he cared about someone who refused to tell him any of the things friends shared with each other, how he had lived before they met, what he feared, what he craved, who he was attracted to, the mortifications and sadnesses of daily life. In the absence of talking to Jude himself, he often wished he could talk to Harold about Jude and figure out how much he knew, and whether, if they, and Andy, braided together all their knowledge, they might be able to find some sort of solution. But this was dreaming. Jude would never forgive him. And instead of the connection he did have with him, he would have none at all. Back in his apartment, he shuffled quickly through his mail. He rarely got anything of interest. Everything business-related went to his agent or lawyer. Anything personal went to Jude's. Found the copy of the script he'd forgotten there the week before when he stopped by the apartment after the gym, and left again. He didn't even take off his coat. Since he'd bought the apartment a year ago, he'd spent a total of 6 weeks there. There was a futon in the bedroom, and the coffee table from Lispinard Street in the living room, and the scuffed Eames fiberglass chair that J.B. had found in the street, and his boxes of books. But that was it. In theory, Malcolm was meant to be renovating the space, converting the airless little study near the kitchen into a dining alcove, and addressing a list of other issues as well. But Malcolm, as if sensing Willem's lack of interest, had made the apartment his last priority. He complained about this sometimes, but he knew it wasn't Malcolm's fault. After all, he hadn't answered Malcolm's emails about finishes or tiles or the dimensions of the built-in bookcase or banquette that Malcolm needed him to approve before he ordered the millwork. It was only recently that he'd had his lawyer's office send Malcolm the final paperwork he needed to begin construction, and the following week they were finally going to sit down and he was going to make some decisions, and when he returned home in mid-January, the apartment would be, Malcolm promised him, if not totally transformed, then at least greatly improved. In the meantime, he still more or less lived with Jude, into whose apartment on Green Street he'd moved directly after he and Philippa had broken up. He used his unfinished apartment and the promise he'd made to Andy as the reasons for his apparently interminable occupation of Jude's extra bedroom, but the fact was that he needed Jude's company and the constancy of his presence. When he was away in England, in Ireland, in California, in France, in Tangiers, in Algeria, in India, in the Philippines, in Canada, he needed to have an image of what was waiting for him back home in New York, and that image never included Perry Street. Home for him was Green Street, and when he was far away and lonely, he thought of Green Street and his room there, and how on weekends, after Jude finished working, they would stay up late, talking, and he would feel time slow and expand, letting him believe the night might stretch out forever. And now he was finally going home. He ran down the stairs and out the front door and onto Perry Street. The evening had turned cold, and he walked quickly, almost trotting, enjoying, as he always did, the pleasure of walking by himself, of feeling alone in a city of so many. It was one of the things he missed the most. On film sets, you were never alone. An assistant director walked you to your trailer and back to the set, even if the trailer and the set were 50 yards away. When he was getting used to sets, he was first startled, then amused, and then, finally, annoyed by the culture of actor infantilization that movie-making seemed to encourage. He sometimes felt that he had been strapped upright to a dolly and was being wheeled from place to place. He was walked to the makeup department and then to the costume department. Then he was walked to the set, and then he was walked back to his trailer, and then, an hour or two later, he would be collected from the trailer and escorted to the set once again. "Don't let me ever get used to this," he'd instruct Jude, begging him almost. It was the concluding line to all his stories, about the lunches at which everyone segregated themselves by rank and caste, actors and the director at one table, cameramen at another, electricians at a third, the grips at a fourth, the costume department at a fifth, and you made small talk about your workouts and restaurants you wanted to try and diets you were on and trainers and cigarettes, how much you wanted one, and facials, how much you needed one, about the crew, who both hated the actors and yet were embarrassingly susceptible to even the slightest attention from them, about the cattiness of the hair and makeup team, who knew an almost bewildering amount of information about all the actors' lives, having learned to keep perfectly quiet and make themselves perfectly invisible as they adjusted hairpieces and dabbed on foundation and listened to actresses screaming at their boyfriends and actors whisperingly arranging late-night hookups on their phones, all while sitting in their chairs. It was on these sets that he realized he was more guarded than he'd always imagined himself, and also how easy, how tempting it was to begin to believe that the life of the set, where everything was fetched for you and where the sun could literally be made to shine on you, was actual life. Once he had been standing on his mark as the cinematographer made a last adjustment before coming over and cupping his head gently. "His hair," barked the first assistant director warningly, and tilting it an inch to the left, and then to the right, and then to the left again, as if he was positioning a vase on a mantle. "Don't move, Willem," he'd cautioned, and he'd promised he wouldn't, barely breathing, but really he had wanted to break into giggles. He suddenly thought of his parents, whom, disconcertingly, he thought of more and more as he grew older, and of Hemming, and for half a second he saw them standing just off the set to his left, just far enough out of range so he couldn't see their faces, whose expressions he wouldn't have been able to imagine anyway. He liked telling Jude all of these things, making his days on set something funny and bright. This was not what he thought acting would be, but what had he known about what acting would be? He was always prepared, he was always on time, he was polite to everyone, he did what the cinematographer told him to do, and argued with the director only when absolutely necessary. But even all these films later, 12 in the past 5 years, 8 of them in the past 2, and through all of their absurdities, he finds most surreal the minute before the camera begins rolling. He stands at his first mark, he stands at his second mark. The cameraman announces he's ready. "Vanities!" shouts the first assistant director. And the vanities, hair, makeup, costume, hurry over to descend upon him as if he is carrion, plucking at his hair and straightening his shirt and tickling his eyelids with their soft brushes. It takes only 30 seconds or so, but in those 30 seconds, his lashes lowered so stray powder doesn't float into his eyes, other people's hands moving possessively over his body and head as if they're no longer his own, he has the strange sensation that he is gone, that he is suspended, and that his very life is an imagining. In those seconds, a whirl of images whips through his mind, too quickly and jumblingly to effectively identify each as it occurs to him. There is the scene he's about to shoot, of course, and the scene he'd shot earlier, but also the things that occupy him, always. The things he sees and hears and remembers before he falls asleep at night. Hemming and J.B. and Malcolm and Harold and Julia. "Jude, are you happy?" he once asked Jude. They must have been drunk. "I don't think happiness is for me," Jude had said at last, as if Willem had been offering him a dish he didn't want to eat. "But it's for you, Willem." As vanities tug and yank at him, it occurs to him that he should have asked Jude what he meant by that. Why was it for him and not for Jude? But by the time he's finished shooting the scene, he won't remember the question or the conversation that inspired it. "Roll sound!" yells the first AD, and vanities scatter. Speed, the sound person answers, which means he's rolling. Roll camera, calls the cameraman, and then there's the announcement of the scene and the clap. And then he opens his eyes. Chapter 2. One Saturday morning, shortly after he turns 36, he opens his eyes and experiences that strange, lovely sensation he sometimes has, the one in which he realizes that his life is cloudless. He imagines Harold and Julia in Cambridge, the two of them moving dozily through the kitchen, pouring coffee into their stained and chipped mugs and shaking the dew off of their plastic newspaper bags, and in the air, Willem flying toward him from Cape Town. He pictures Malcolm pressed against Sophie in bed in Brooklyn, and then, because he feels hopeful, J.B. safe and snoring in his bed on the Lower East Side. Here, on Green Street, the radiator releases its sibilant sigh. The sheets smell like soap and sky. Above him is the tubular steel chandelier Malcolm installed a month ago. Beneath him is a gleaming black wood floor. The apartment, still impossible in its vastness and possibilities and potential, is silent and his. He points his toes toward the bottom of the bed and then flexes them toward his shins. Nothing. He shifts his back against the mattress. Nothing. He draws his knees toward his chest. Nothing. Nothing hurts. Nothing even threatens to hurt. His body is his again, something that will perform for him whatever he can imagine, without complaint or sabotage. He closes his eyes, not because he's tired, but because it is a perfect moment, and he knows how to enjoy them. These moments never last for long. Sometimes all he has to do is sit up, and he will be reminded, as if slapped across the face, that his body owns him, not the other way around. But in recent years, as things have gotten worse, he has worked very hard to give up the idea that he will ever improve, and has instead tried to concentrate on and be grateful for the moments of reprieve, whenever and wherever his body chooses to bestow them. Finally, he sits, slowly, and then stands, just as slowly. And still, he feels wonderful. A good day, he decides, and walks to the bathroom, past the wheelchair that sulks, a sullen ogre, in a corner of his bedroom. He gets ready and then sits down with some papers from the office to wait. Generally, he spends most of Saturday at work. That, at least, hasn't changed from the days he used to take his walks. Oh, his walks. Was that once him? Someone who could trip, goat-like, to the Upper East Side and home again, all 11 miles on his own? But today he's meeting Malcolm and taking him to his suitmaker's because Malcolm is going to get married and needs to buy a suit. They're not completely certain if Malcolm is actually getting married or not. They think he is. Over the past 3 years, he and Sophie have broken up and gotten back together and broken up and gotten back together. But in the past year, Malcolm has had conversations with Willem about weddings. And does Willem think they're an indulgence or not? And with J.B. about jewelry, and when women say they don't like diamonds, do they really mean it? Or are they just testing the way it sounds? And with him about prenuptial agreements. He had answered Malcolm's questions as best he could, and then had given him the name of a classmate from law school, a matrimonial attorney. Oh, Malcolm had said, moving backward, as if he had offered him the name of a professional assassin. I'm not sure I need this yet, Jude. All right, he said, and withdrew the card, which Malcolm seemed unwilling to even touch. Well, if and when you do, just ask. And then, a month ago, Malcolm had asked if he could help him pick out a suit. I don't even really have one. Isn't that nuts? He asked. Don't you think I should have one? Don't you think I should start looking, I don't know, more grown up or something? Don't you think it'd be good for business? I think you look great, Mal, he said. And I don't think you need any help on the business front. But if you want one, sure, I'm happy to help you. Thanks, said Malcolm. I mean, it's just something I should have, you know, just in case something comes up. He paused. I can't believe you have a suit maker, by the way. He smiled. "He's not my suit maker," he said. "He's just someone who makes suits, and some of them happen to be mine."
"God," said Malcolm. "Harold really created a monster."
He laughed, obligingly. But he often feels as if a suit is the only thing that makes him look normal. For the months he was in a wheelchair, those suits were a way of reassuring his clients that he was competent and, simultaneously, of reassuring himself that he belonged with the others, that he could at least dress the way they did. He didn't consider himself vain, but rather scrupulous. When he was a child, the boys from the home would occasionally play baseball games with the boys from the local school, who would taunt them, pinching their noses as they walked onto the field. "Take a bath," they would shout. "You smell, you smell." But they did bathe. They had mandatory showers every morning, pumping the greasy pink soap into their palms and onto their washcloths, and sloughing off their skin while one of the counselors walked back and forth before the row of showerheads, cracking one of the thin towels at the boys who were misbehaving, or shouting at the ones who weren't cleaning themselves with enough vigor. Even now, he has a horror of repulsing by being unkempt or dirty or unsightly. "You'll always be ugly, but that doesn't mean you can't be neat," Father Gabriel used to tell him. And although Father Gabriel was wrong about many things, he knows he was right about this. Malcolm arrives and hugs him hello and then begins, as he always does, surveying the space, telescoping his long neck and rotating in a slow circle around the room, his gaze like a lighthouse's beam, making little assessing noises as he does. He answers Malcolm's question before he can ask it.
"Next month, Ma."
"You said that 3 months ago."
"I know, but now I really mean it. Now I have the money. Or I will at the end of the month."
"But we discussed this."
"I know.
And Malcolm, it's so unbelievably generous of you, but I'm not going to not pay you."
He has lived in the apartment for more than 4 years now. And for 4 years, he's been unable to renovate it because he hasn't had the money, and he hasn't had the money because he was paying off the apartment. In the meantime, Malcolm has drawn up plans and walled off the bedrooms and helped him choose a sofa, which sits, a gray spacecraft, in the center of the living room, and fixed some minor problems, including the floors.
"That's crazy," he had told Malcolm at the time. "You're going to have to redo it entirely once the renovation's done."
But Malcolm had said he'd do it anyway. The floor dye was a new product he wanted to try, and until he was ready to begin work, Green Street would be his laboratory, where he could do a little experimentation, if he didn't mind. And he didn't, of course. But otherwise, the apartment is still very much as it was when he moved in, a long rectangle on the sixth floor of a building in southern Soho, with windows at either end, one set facing west and the other facing east, as well as the entire southern wall, which looks over a parking lot. His room and bathroom are at the eastern-facing end, which looks onto the top of a stubby building on Mercer Street. Willem's rooms, or what he continues to think of as Willem's rooms, are at the western-facing end, which looks over Green Street. There is a kitchen in the middle of the apartment, and a third bathroom. And in between the two suites of rooms are acres of space, the black floors shiny as piano keys. It is still an unfamiliar feeling to have so much space, and a stranger one to be able to afford it. "But you can," he has to remind himself sometimes, just as he does when he stands in the grocery store, wondering whether he should buy a tub of the black olives he likes, which are so salty they make his mouth pucker and his eyes water. When he first moved to the city, they were an indulgence, and he'd buy them just once a month, one glistening spoonful at a time. Every night he'd eat only one, sucking the meat slowly off the stone as he sat reading briefs. "You can buy them," he tells himself. "You have the money." But he still finds it difficult to remember. The reason behind Green Street and the container of olives that are usually in the refrigerator is his job at Rosen, Pritchard & Klein, one of the city's most powerful and prestigious firms, where he is a litigator, and for little more than a year now, a partner. 5 years ago, he and Citizen and Rhodes had been working on a case concerning securities fraud at a large commercial bank called Thackeray Smith, and shortly after the case had settled, he had been contacted by a man named Lucien Voigt, whom he knew was the chair of the litigation department at Rosen, Pritchard & Kline, and who had represented Thackeray Smith in their negotiations. Voigt asked him to have a drink. He had been impressed by his work, especially in the courtroom, he said. And Thackeray Smith had been as well. He had heard of him anyway. He and Judge Sullivan had been on law review together and had researched him. Had he ever considered leaving the U.S. Attorney's Office and coming to the dark side? He would have been lying if he said he hadn't. All around him, people were leaving. Citizen, he knew, was talking to an international firm in Washington, D.C. Rhodes was wondering whether he should go in-house at a bank. He himself had been approached by two other firms and had turned them both down. They loved the U.S. Attorney's Office, all of them. But Citizen and Rhodes were older than he was, and Rhodes and his wife wanted to have a baby, and they needed to make money. Money, money. It was all they spoke of sometimes. He, too, thought of money. It was impossible not to. Every time he came home from a party at one of J.B.'s or Malcolm's friends' apartments, Lispinard Street seemed a little shabbier, a little less tolerable. Every time the elevator broke and he had to walk up the flights of stairs and then rest on the floor in the hallway, his back against their front door before he had the energy to let himself in, he dreamed of living somewhere functional and reliable. Every time he was standing at the top of the subway stairs, readying himself for the climb down, gripping the handrail, and nearly breathing through his mouth with effort, he would wish he could take a taxi. And then there were other fears, bigger fears. In his very dark moments, he imagined himself as an old man, his skin stretched vellum-like over his ribs, still in Lispinard Street, pulling himself on his elbows to the bathroom because he was no longer able to walk. In this dream, he was alone. There was no Willem or J.B. or Malcolm or Andy, no Harold or Julia. He was an old, old man, and there was no one, and he was the only one left to take care of himself. "How old are you?" asked Voigt.
31, he said.
31's young, said Voigt. But you won't be young forever. Do you really want to grow old in the U.S. Attorney's Office? You know what they say about assistant prosecutors, men whose best years are behind them.
He talked about compensation, about an accelerated path to partnership.
Just tell me you'll think about it.
I will, he said.
And he did. He didn't discuss it with Citizen or Rhodes or Harold, because he knew what he'd say, but he did discuss it with Willem. And together they debated the obvious benefits of the job against the obvious drawbacks. The hours, but he never left work as it was, Willem argued, the tedium, the high probability he'd be working with assholes, but Citizen and Rhodes aside, he already worked with assholes, Willem argued. And, of course, the fact that he would now be defending the people he'd spent the past 6 years prosecuting. Liars and crooks and thieves, the entitled and the powerful, masquerading as victims. He wasn't like Harold or Citizen. He was practical. He knew that making a career as a lawyer meant sacrifices, either of money or of moralities, but it still troubled him, this forsaking of what he knew to be just. And for what? So he could ensure he wouldn't become that old man, lonely and sick? It seemed the worst kind of selfishness, the worst kind of self-indulgence, to disavow what he knew was right simply because he was frightened, because he was scared of being uncomfortable and miserable. Then, 2 weeks after his meeting with Voigt, he had come home one Friday night, very late. He was exhausted. He'd had to use his wheelchair that day because the wound on his right leg hurt him so much, and he was so relieved to get home, back to Lispinard Street, that he had felt himself go weak. In just a few minutes he would be inside, and he would wrap a damp washcloth, hot and steamed from the microwave, around his calf and sit in the warmth. But when he tried the elevator button, he heard nothing but a grinding of gears, the faint winching noise the machine made when it was broken.
No, he shouted.
No!
His voice echoed in the lobby, and he smacked his palm against the elevator door again and again.
No, no, no!
He picked up his briefcase and threw it against the ground, and papers spun up from it. Around him, the building remained silent and unhelpful. Finally, he stopped, ashamed and angry, and gathered his papers back into his bag. He checked his watch. It was 11. Willem was in a play, Cloud 9, but he knew he'd be off stage by then. But when he called him, Willem didn't pick up. And then he began to panic. Malcolm was on vacation in Greece. JB was at an artist's colony. Andy's daughter, Beatrice, had just been born the previous week. He couldn't call him. There were only so many people he would let help him, whom he felt at least semi-comfortable clinging to like a sloth, whom he would allow to drag him up the many flights. But in that moment, he was irrationally, intensely desperate to get into the apartment, and so he stood, tucking his briefcase under his left arm and collapsing his wheelchair, which was too expensive to leave in the lobby, with his right. He began to work his way up the stairs, cleaving his left side to the wall, gripping the chair by one of its spokes. He moved slowly. He had to hop on his left leg while trying to avoid putting any weight on his right or letting the wheelchair bang against the wound. Up he went, pausing to rest every third step. There were 110 steps from the lobby to the fifth floor, and by the 50th, he was shaking so badly he had to stop and sit for half an hour. He called and texted Willem again and again. On the fourth call, he left the message he hoped he would never have to leave.
Willem, I really need help. Please call me. Please.
He had a vision of Willem calling him right back, telling him he'd be right there. But he waited and waited, and Willem didn't call. And finally, he managed to stand again. Somehow, he made it inside. But he can't remember anything else from that night. When he woke the next day, Willem was asleep on the rug next to his bed, and Andy asleep on the chair they must have dragged into his room from the living room. He was thick-tongued, fogged, nauseated, and he knew that Andy must have given him an injection of pain medication, which he hated. He would feel disoriented and constipated for days. When he woke again, Willem was gone, but Andy was awake and staring at him.
Jude, you've got to get the fuck out of this apartment, he said quietly.
I know, he said.
Jude, what were you thinking?
Willem asked him later, after he had returned from the grocery store and Andy had helped him into the bathroom. He couldn't walk. Andy had had to carry him. And then put him back into bed, still in his clothes from the day before, and left. Willem had gone to a party after the show and hadn't heard his phone ring. When he had finally listened to his messages, he had rushed home and found him convulsing on the floor and had called Andy.
Why didn't you call Andy? Why didn't you go to a diner and wait for me? Why didn't you call Richard? Why didn't you call Philippa and make her find me? Why didn't you call Citizen or Rhodes or Eli or Phaedra or the Henry Youngs or...
I don't know, he said miserably. It was impossible to explain to the healthy the logic of the sick, and he didn't have the energy to try. The following week, he contacted Lucien Voigt and finalized the terms of the job with him. And once he had signed the contract, he called Harold, who was silent for a long 5 seconds before taking a deep breath and beginning.
I just don't get this, Jude, he said. I don't. You've never struck me as a money grubber, are you? I mean, I guess you are. You have a great career at the U.S. Attorney's. You're doing work there that matters, and you're giving it all up to defend who? Criminals. People so entitled, so certain they won't be caught, that being caught, that very concern, doesn't even occur to them. People who think the laws are written for people who make less than 9 figures a year. People who think the laws are applicable only by race or by tax bracket.
He said nothing and just let Harold become more and more agitated, because he knew Harold was right. They had never explicitly discussed it, but he knew Harold had always assumed that he would make his career in public service. Over the years, Harold would talk with dismay and sorrow about talented former students he admired who had left jobs at the U.S. Attorney's, at the Department of Justice, at public defender offices, at legal aid programs, to go to corporate firms. A society cannot run as it should unless people with excellent legal minds make it their business to make it run, Harold often said, and he had always agreed with him. And he agreed with him still, which was why he couldn't defend himself now. "Don't you have anything you want to say for yourself?" Harold asked him, finally. "I'm sorry, Harold," he said. Harold said nothing. "You're so angry at me," he murmured. "I'm not angry, Jude," Harold said. "I'm disappointed. Do you know how special you are? Do you know what a difference you could make if you stayed? You could be a judge if you wanted to. You could be a justice someday. But you're not going to be now. Now you're going to be another litigator in another corporate firm. And all the good work you could have done, you'll instead be fighting against. It's just such a waste, Jude. Such a waste." He was silent again. He repeated Harold's words to himself. "Such a waste. Such a waste." Harold sighed. "So what is this about, really?" he asked. "Is it money? Is this what this is about? Why didn't you tell me you needed money, Jude? I could have given you some. Is this all about money? Tell me what you need, Jude, and I'm happy to help you out." "Harold," he began, that's so kind of you, but I can't." "Bullshit," said Harold. "You won't. I'm offering you a way to let you keep your job, Jude, to not have to take a job you're going to hate. For work, you will hate. And that's not a maybe, that's a fact. With no expectations or strings attached. I'm telling you that I'm happy to give you money for this." "Oh, Harold," he thought. "Harold," he said wretchedly. "The kind of money I need isn't the kind of money you have. I promise you." Harold was silent, and when he spoke next, his tone was different. "Jude, are you in any kind of trouble? You can tell me, you know. Whatever it is, I'll help you." "No," he said, but he wanted to cry. "No, Harold, I'm fine." He wrapped his right hand around his bandaged calf with its steady, constant ache. "Well," said Harold, "that's a relief. But, Jude, what could you possibly need so much money for besides an apartment, which Julia and I will help you buy? Do you hear me?" He sometimes found himself both frustrated and fascinated by Harold's lack of imagination. In Harold's mind, people had parents who were proud of them and saved money only for apartments and vacations and asked for things when they wanted them. He seemed to be curiously unaware of a universe in which those things might not be givens, in which not everyone shared the same past and future. But this was a highly ungenerous way to think, and it was rare. Most of the time he admired Harold's steadfast optimism, his inability or unwillingness to be cynical, to look for unhappiness or misery in every situation. He loved Harold's innocence, which was made more remarkable considering what he taught and what he had lost. And so how could he tell Harold that he had to consider wheelchairs, which needed to be replaced every few years and which insurance didn't wholly cover? How could he tell him that Andy, who didn't take insurance, never charged him, had never charged him, but might want to someday, and if he did, he certainly wasn't not going to pay him? How could he tell him that this most recent time his wound had opened, Andy had mentioned hospitalization and maybe someday in the future, amputation? How could he tell him that if his leg was amputated, it would mean a hospital stay and physical therapy and prostheses? How could he tell him about the surgery he wanted on his back, the laser burning his carapace of scars down to nothing? How could he tell Harold of his deepest fears, his loneliness, of becoming the old man with a catheter and a bony, bare chest? How could he tell Harold that he dreamed not of marriage or children, but that he would someday have enough money to pay someone to take care of him if he needed it, someone who would be kind to him
and allow him privacy and dignity. And then, yes, there were the things he wanted. He wanted to live somewhere where the elevator worked. He wanted to take cabs when he wanted to. He wanted to find somewhere private to swim, because the motion stilled his back, and because he wasn't able to take his walks any longer. But he couldn't tell Harold any of this. He didn't want Harold to know just how flawed he was, what a piece of junk he'd acquired. And so he said nothing, and told Harold he had to go, and that he would talk to him later. Even before he had talked to Harold, he had prepared himself to be resigned to his new job, nothing more, but to first his unease, and then to his surprise, and then his delight, and then his slight disgust, he found that he enjoyed it. He'd had experience with pharmaceutical companies when he was a prosecutor, and so much of his initial caseload concerned that industry. He worked with a company that was opening an Asia-based subsidiary to develop an anti-corruption policy, traveling back and forth to Tokyo with the senior partner on the case. This was a small, tidy, solvable job, and therefore unusual. The other cases were more complicated, and longer, at times infinitely long. He mostly worked on compiling a defense for another of the firm's clients, this a massive pharmaceutical conglomerate, against a False Claims Act charge. And 3 years into his life at Rosen, Pritchard, and Klein, when the investment management company Rhodes worked for was investigated for securities fraud, they came to him and secured his partnership. He had trial experience, which most of the other associates didn't. But he had known he would need to bring in a client eventually, and the first client was always the hardest to find. He would never have admitted it to Harold, but he actually liked directing investigations prompted by whistleblowers, liked pressing up against the boundaries of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, liked being able to stretch the law like a strip of elastic just past its natural tension point, just to the point where it would snap back at you with a sting. By day, he told himself it was an intellectual engagement, that his work was an expression of the plasticity of the law itself. But at night, he would sometimes think of what Harold would say if he was honest with him about what he was doing, and would hear his words again. Such a waste. Such a waste. What was he doing, he would think in those moments. Had the job made him venal? Or had he always been so and had just fancied himself otherwise? It's all within the law, he would argue with the Harold in his head. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should, Harold in his head would shoot back at him. And indeed, Harold hadn't been completely wrong, for he missed the U.S. Attorney's Office. He missed being righteous and surrounded by the passionate, the heated, the crusading. He missed Citizen, who had moved back to London, and Marshall, whom he occasionally met for drinks, and Rhodes, whom he saw more frequently but who was perpetually frazzled and gray, and whom he had remembered as cheery and effervescent. Someone who would play electro-tango music and squire an imaginary woman around the room when they were at the office late and feeling punchy, just to get him and Citizen to look up from their computers and laugh. They were getting older, all of them. He liked Rosen Pritchard. He liked the people there. But he never sat with them late at night, arguing about cases and talking about books. It wasn't that sort of office. The associates his age had unhappy girlfriends or boyfriends at home, or were themselves unhappy girlfriends or boyfriends. The ones older than he were getting married. In the rare moments they weren't discussing the work before them, they made small talks about engagements and pregnancies and real estate. They didn't discuss the law, not for fun or from fervor. The firm encouraged its attorneys to do pro bono work, and he began volunteering with a non-profit group that offered free legal advice to artists. The organization kept what they called studio hours every afternoon and evening, when artists could drop by and consult with a lawyer, and every Wednesday night he left work early at 7 and sat in the group's creaky-floored Soho offices on Broome Street for 3 hours, helping small publishers of radical treatises who wanted to establish themselves as non-profit entities, and painters with intellectual property disputes
and dance groups, photographers, writers, and filmmakers with contracts that were either so extra-legal, he was presented with one written in pencil on a paper towel, that they were meaningless or so needlessly complicated that the artists couldn't understand them, he could barely understand them, and yet had signed them anyway. Harold didn't really approve of his volunteer work either. He could tell he thought it was frivolous. "Are any of these artists any good?" Harold asked. "Probably not," he said. But it wasn't for him to judge whether the artists were good or not. Other people, plenty of other people, did that already. He was there only to offer the sort of practical help that so few of them had, and as so many of them lived in a world that was deaf to practicalities. He knew it was romantic, but he admired them. He admired anyone who could live for year after year on only their fast-burning hopes, even as they grew older and more obscure with every day. And just as romantically, he thought of his time with the organization as his salute to his friends, all of whom were living the sorts of lives he marveled at. He considered them such successes, and he was proud of them. Unlike him, they had no clear path to follow, and yet they had plowed stubbornly ahead. They spent their days making beautiful things. His friend Richard was on the board of the organization, and some Wednesdays he'd stop by on his way home. He had recently moved to Soho, and sit and talk with him if he was between clients, or just give him a wave across the room if he was occupied. One night after studio hours, Richard invited him back to his apartment for a drink, and they walked west on Broome Street, past Center and Lafayette and Crosby and Broadway and Mercer, before turning south on Green. Richard lived in a narrow building, its stone gone the color of soot, with a towering garage door marking its first floor, and to its right, a metal door with a face-size glass window cut into its top. There was no lobby, but rather a gray, tiled floor hallway lit by a series of three glowing bare bulbs dangling from cords. The hallway turned right and led to a cell-like industrial elevator, the size of their living room and Willem's bedroom at Lispinard Street combined, with a rattling cage door that shuttered shut at the press of a button, but which glided smoothly up through an exposed cinder-block shaft. At the third floor, it stopped, and Richard opened the cage and turned his key into the set of massive, forbidding steel doors before them, which opened into his apartment. "God," he said, stepping into the space, as Richard flicked on some lights. The floors were whitewashed wood, and the walls were white as well. High above him, the ceiling winked and shone with scores of chandeliers, old, glass, new, steel, that were strung every 3 feet or so at irregular heights, so that as they walked deeper into the loft, he could feel glass bugles skimming across the top of his head, and Richard, who was even taller than he was, had to duck so they wouldn't scrape his forehead. There were no dividing walls, but near the far end of the space was a shallow, freestanding box of glass as tall and wide as the front doors. And as he drew closer, he could see that within it was a gigantic honeycomb shaped like a graceful piece of fan coral. Beyond the glass box was a blanket-covered mattress, and before it was a shaggy white Berber rug, its mirrors twinkling in the lights, and a white woolen sofa and television, an odd island of domesticity in the midst of so much aridity. It was the largest apartment he had ever been in. "It's not real," said Richard, watching him look at the honeycomb. "I made it from wax." "It's spectacular," he said, and Richard nodded his thanks. "Come on," he said. "I'll give you the tour." He handed him a beer and then unbolted a door next to the refrigerator. "Emergency stairs," he said. "I love them. They're so descent into hell looking, you know." "They are," he agreed, looking into the doorway, where the stairs seemed to vanish into the gloom. And then he stepped back, suddenly uneasy, and yet feeling foolish for being so, and Richard, who hadn't seemed to notice, shut the door and bolted it. They went down in the elevator to the second floor and into Richard's studio, and Richard showed him what he was working on. "I call them misrepresentations," he said. and let him hold what he had assumed was a white birch branch, but was actually made from fired clay, and then a stone, round and smooth and lightweight, that had been whittled from ash and lathe-turned, but that gave the suggestion of solidity and heft, and a bird skeleton made of hundreds of small porcelain pieces. Bisecting the space lengthwise was a row of 7 glass boxes, smaller than the one upstairs, with the wax honeycomb, but each still as large as one of the casement windows, and each containing a jagged, crumbling mountain of a sickly, dark yellow substance that appeared to be half rubber, half flesh. "These are real honeycombs, or they were," Richard explained. "I let the bees work on them for a while, and then I released them. Each one is named for how long they were occupied, for how long they were actually a home and a sanctuary." They sat on the rolling leather desk chairs that Richard worked from and drank their beers and talked about Richard's work and about his next show, his second, that would open in 6 months, and about JB's new paintings. "You haven't seen them, right?" Richard asked. "I stopped by his studio 2 weeks ago, and they're really beautiful. The best he's ever done." He smiled at him. "There are going to be a lot of you, you know." "I know," he said, trying not to grimace. "So, Richard," he said, changing the subject, "how did you find this space? It's incredible." "It's mine." "Really? You own it? I'm impressed. That's so adult of you." Richard laughed. "No, the building, it's mine," he explained. His grandparents had an import business, and when his father and his aunt were young, they had bought 16 buildings downtown, all former factories, to store their wares. 6 in Soho, 6 in Tribeca, and 4 in Chinatown. When each of their 4 grandchildren turned 30, they got one of the buildings. When they turned 35, as Richard had the previous year, they got another. When they turned 40, they got a third. They would get the last when they turned 50. "Did you get to choose?" he asked, feeling that particular mix of giddiness and disbelief he did whenever he heard these kinds of stories. Both that such wealth existed and could be discussed so casually, and that someone he had known for such a long time was in possession of it. They were reminders of how naive and unsophisticated he somehow still was. He could never imagine such riches. He could never imagine people he knew had such riches. Even all these years later, even though his years in New York and especially his job had taught him differently, he couldn't help but imagine the rich not as Ezra or Richard or Malcolm, but as they were depicted in cartoons, in satires. Older men stamping out of cars with dark-tinted windows and fat-fingered and plush and shinily bald, with skinny, brittle wives and large, polished floor houses. "No," Richard grinned. "They gave us the ones they thought would best suit our personalities. My grouchy cousin got a building on Franklin Street that was used to store vinegar." He laughed. "What was this one used for?" "I'll show you." And so back in the elevator they went, up to the 4th floor, where Richard opened the door and turned on the lights, and they were confronted with pallets and pallets stacked high, almost to the ceiling, with what he thought were bricks. "But not just bricks," said Richard. "Decorative terracotta bricks. Imported from Umbria." He picked one up from an incomplete pallet and gave it to him, and he turned the brick, which was glazed with a thin, bright green finish, in his hand, running his palm over its blisters. "The 5th and 6th floors are full of them, too," said Richard. "They're in the process of selling them to a wholesaler in Chicago, and then those floors will be clear." He smiled. "Now you see why I have such a good elevator in here." They returned to Richard's apartment, back through the hanging garden of chandeliers, and Richard gave him another beer. "Listen," he said, "I need to talk to you about something important." "Anything," he said, placing the bottle on the table and leaning forward. "The tiles will probably be out of here by the end of the year," said Richard. "The 5th and 6th floors are set up exactly like this one, wet walls in the same place, 3 bathrooms, and the question is whether you'd want one of them." "Richard," he said, "I'd love to, but how much are you charging?" "I'm not talking about renting it, Jude," said Richard. "I'm talking about buying it." Richard had already talked to his father, who was his grandparents' lawyer. They'd convert the building into a co-op, and he'd buy a certain number of shares. The only thing Richard's family requested is that he or his heirs give them the right to buy the apartment back from him first if he ever decided to sell it. They would offer him a fair price, and he would pay Richard a monthly rent that would be applied toward his purchase. The Goldfarbs had done this before. His grouchy cousin's girlfriend had bought a floor of the Vinegar Building a year ago, and it had worked out fine. Apparently, they got some sort of tax break if they each converted one of their buildings into at least a two-unit co-op, and so Richard's father was trying to get all of the grandchildren to do so. "Why are you doing this?" he asked Richard, quietly, once he had recovered. "Why me?" Richard shrugged. "It gets lonely here," he said. "Not that I'm going to be stopping by all the time, but it'd be nice to know there's another living being in this building sometimes. And you're the most responsible of my friends, not that there's a lot of competition for the title. And I like your company. Also," he stopped, "promise you won't get mad?" "Oh, God," he said. "But I promise." "Willem told me about what happened, you know, when you were trying to get upstairs last year and the elevator broke. It's not anything to be embarrassed about, Jude. He's just worried about you. I told him I was going to ask you about this anyway, and he thinks it's someplace you could live for a long time. Forever. And the elevator will never break here. And if it does, I'll be right downstairs. I mean, obviously you can buy somewhere else, but I hope you'll consider moving in here." In that moment, he feels not angry, but exposed. Not just to Richard, but to Willem. He tries to hide as much as he can from Willem, not because he doesn't trust him, but because he doesn't want Willem to see him as less of a person, as someone who has to be looked after and helped. He wants Willem, wants them all, to think of him as someone reliable and hardy, someone they can come to with their problems, instead of him always having to turn to them. He is embarrassed, thinking of the conversations that have been had about him, between Willem and Andy, and between Willem and Harold, which he is certain happens more often than he fears, and now between Willem and Richard, and saddened as well that Willem is spending so much time worrying about him, that he is having to think of him the way he would have had to think of Hemming, had Hemming lived, as someone who needed care, as someone who needed decisions made for him. He sees the image of himself as an old man again. Is it possible it is also Willem's vision? That the two of them share the same fear? That his ending seems as inevitable to Willem as it does to himself? He thinks then of a conversation he had once had with Willem and Philippa. Philippa was talking about how someday, when she and Willem were old, they'd take over her parents' house and orchards in southern Vermont. "I can see it now," she said. "The kids will have moved back in with us because they won't be able to make it in the real world, and they'll have six kids between them with names like Buster and Carrot and Vixen, who'll run around naked and won't be sent to school, and whom Willem and I will have to support until the end of time." "What will your kids do?" he asked, practical even in play. "Oberon will make art installations using only food products, and Miranda will play a zither with yarn for strings," said Philippa, and he had smiled. "They'll stay in grad school forever, and Willem will have to keep working until he's so broken down that I have to push him onto the set in a wheelchair." She stopped, blushing, but carried on after a hitch. "To pay for all their degrees and experiments. I'll have to give up costume design and start an organic applesauce company to pay all our debts and maintain the house, which will be this huge, glorious wreck with termites everywhere, and we'll have a huge, scarred wooden table big enough to seat all 12 of us."
13, said Willem. Suddenly.
"Why 13?
"Because Jude'll be living with us too."
"Oh, will I?"
he asked lightly, but pleased and relieved to be included in Willem's vision of old age.
"Of course. You'll have the guest cottage, and every morning Buster will bring you your buckwheat waffles because you'll be too sick of us to join us at the main table, and then after breakfast I'll come hang out with you and hide from Oberon and Miranda, who are going to want me to make intelligent and supportive comments about their latest endeavors."
Willem grinned at him, and he smiled back, though he could see that Philippa herself wasn't smiling any longer, but staring at the table. Then he looked up, and their eyes met for half a second, and she looked away quickly. It was shortly after that, he thought, that Philippa's attitude toward him changed. It wasn't obvious to